Hello, and you are listening to CITR 101.9 FM. Thank you for tuning in. This is Democracy Watch, the News Collective's weekly news report, bringing you alternative and undercovered current affairs from Vancouver and the Lower Mainland. My name is Alex DeBoer.
And I'm Lyndon Wong.
It's Thursday, November 15th at 5.02 p.m. We are broadcasting from UBC's Vancouver campus on the ancestral, traditional, and unceded territories of the Hunkaminam-speaking Musqueam people. On today's show, we're going to be featuring a piece on community TV. That is something that I did not understand up until very recently. Didn't know it was a thing, but we're going to learn all about it. So the reason I was prompted to learn about it was because I attended a screening of a collection of documentary footage by local activist and videographer Sid Chow Tan. So since the mid-80s, Sid has documented environmental and social justice movements in the city, and he did so through a nearly non-existent medium called community TV.
After that, we have another piece regarding the rally held by the Vancouver's Tenant Union in support of motions proposed by City Councillor Gene Swanson. The motions proposed involved banning renovation and making housing 100% welfare and pension affordable. Reporters Sam Jones and Lyndon Wong attended the rally on November 14th at City Hall to take a deeper look at the rally.
Yeah, I'm excited to hear that one too. So first, let's hear about community television let's hear some footage of Sid Chow Tan's collection, which is really great to hear. We're going to hear about Wood Squat and the Chinese head tax apology that was only finally given in 2006. So let's learn about community TV and hear some of his footage. Here we go.
All step towards that. And yeah, I guess to introduce the actual event is that, so Sid and I met maybe like three years ago when I moved here. So I moved here 3 years ago from Montreal, and I guess I started hanging around like Chinatown organizers and particularly Chinatown Action Group, and I think we met at a meeting there, right?
Yeah.
We did. So I met Sid and I was like, wow, this guy's sick. I think I actually, in particular, you had a cool t-shirt. It was like the Milwaukee one.
Oh, okay.
That's me.
For sale.
It's for sale. Oh, you can't buy it? Is it actually, is there any repetition? Anyways, so Sid had a cool t-shirt, but it was when we were organizing.
It's Friday, November 2nd, and we're sitting in Pollyanna Library, an arts and community space on Georgia Street in Chinatown. What you're hearing is Vincent Tao, a Chinatown activist and member of Our Homes Can't Wait and the Chinatown Action Group. He's introducing a man named Sid Chow Tan, also a Chinatown activist, but some decades his senior.
But I learned from Sid, like, people started telling me, it's like, oh, yo, you should check out Sid's videos. And I did. And Sid, I don't know, I can introduce you properly later, but it's just, Sid has this, like, amazing wealth of just like this gigantic archive of you know, the kind of underside history of Vancouver, its history of struggle, and I think this is really important to you know, our organizing today is that a lot of what the city does.
Sid Chow Tan, now 70, began his professional life as a stockbroker, but in the mid 80s became involved in community activism, particularly the struggle for redress of the Chinese head tax and exclusion laws. Vincent sees Sid as part of a historical process, a lineage, as he puts it, of activists fighting against greed and gentrification in Vancouver.
Its active erasure is part of like a kind of like longer scheme of redevelopment and domination by the capitalist class.
The reason Vince and Sid are sitting in front of an audience in Pollyanna Library on this Friday afternoon is to screen selections from Sid's archive of self-produced documentary footage in honor of Vancouver Independent Archives Week 2018 and the 15th annual Downtown Eastside Heart of the City Festival. Because in addition to being a Vancouver social and environmental justice activist, Sid Chow Tan spent decades capturing Vancouver activism on camera.
Anyway, so let's start the videos.
The next part in the writing of the wrong in Canadian history is this: the Chinese head tax redress issue.
Sid began videotaping the fight for redress of a punitive head tax on Chinese Canadian immigrants that was imposed between 1885 and 1923.
It took 2 years for the average Chinese worker in 1923 to earn $500.
The Canadian government, under Prime Minister Stephen Harper, apologized for this head tax in 2006. Sid also documented a famous case of anti-development resistance in Vancouver's downtown east side.
Northeast corner of Hastings and Abbott, Vancouver, British Columbia, Canada.
In September of 2002, activists and homeless people living in the downtown east side occupied the Woodward's department store on Hastings and Abbott for 3 months.
Woodward's was already owned by the people, that was given to the people by the last government, and this government took it away. And we're taking it back. We're saying that we will not allow this to be anything but social housing.
The demand for 100% social housing was not met. Instead, Woodward's was redeveloped and opened in 2009 as social mix housing. It includes 536 high-cost condos, 125 units of supportive housing for low-income people, and 75 units of non-market social housing.
And banners, the homeless, the poor, Aboriginal rights, and social justice activists.
Sid Chau Tan captured a host of other events and movements in Vancouver from the mid-80s to the 2010s. After the screening of Sid's footage, Vince discussed Sid's work as an activist and as a documentarian of activism. Sid began to explain that he was able to capture these important social movements and protests because of something called community television.
I came across a early midlife crisis when I was about 30-something, figuring out what I was going to do with the rest of my life. And I ran into community television.
So Sid went on to talk about his involvement in community television and activism more generally, but I was left uncertain of what community television was.
I was just going to ask if you could explain what community television is.
It's nothing now. In Vancouver, it's nothing. In Port Coquitlam, what is that, Mark? Tri-City. Yeah, Tri-Cities TV. They actually, Jeff Scott, and if anybody's interested, you want to tell people, they actually rounded up a bunch of money and got the Tri-Cities to put in, I'm not sure, $25,000 each to support community television and their fundraising, and they're doing it. And as far as I know, that's it except for Belmont, right?
Belmont, I think, yeah.
But what was it back in the day when you started with W2 or Access or before that chant time today? What was it like, and what were the conditions that produced it? You said something about how the cable companies that have monopolized.
Cable companies because cable companies got the monopoly for cable TV. If you notice, at one time, I think some of your, there used to be a Shaw, and then there used to be a Rogers. And prior to Sean Rogers, there used to be, Prime, I think it was? But there were like four or
Sid
five.
Sid went on to talk about how the CRTC, or Canadian Radio and Television Commission, used to require broadcast television companies pay a certain amount into this thing called community television. Sid was fuzzy about some of the details, and in particular why community television doesn't exist or barely exists in British Columbia today. So I decided to call the man he mentioned, Jeff Scott of Tri-Cities Television.
My name's Jeff Scott. I'm the executive director of Tri-Cities Community Television. That's a group out here in the Tri-Cities region, Port Coquitlam, Port Moody. We have a number of volunteers that cover community events, and I provide access to equipment that we've received funding from the cities to purchase.
Okay.
And so that's the community TV sort of resurrecting itself out here in the Tri-Cities area. But I have been involved with ICTV years ago and back when there was community TV with Shaw and Rogers.
Okay, so Sid explained a bit of what community television is in that he said there was sort of a tax that cable companies had to pay to community television to make community television. But can you tell me, about that tax?
And sure. Yeah, I mean, there are other people I could connect you to that could probably explain it far better than I. But essentially, when the cable companies first came into existence, They were given basically licenses to make lots of money, so the CRTC at that time put some prerequisites upon them, such as that they would have to cover local city council meetings. So quite often on Shaw in the old days, you used to see coverage of your local council. It wasn't out of the goodness of their hearts. That was because they were mandated to do so by the CRTC. And likewise with the community channel, that was something that at one time, at its heyday, was a huge community benefit, but it was something that was required of them because of all the other avenues they had to make money. Part of the mandate of the CRTC was that they provide a facility where members of the community could come in, get a little bit of basic training, and learn to produce their own programming that reflected sort of the needs and the concerns of the community as opposed to commercial programming that was on pretty much every other channel.
Right. Do you have any sense of, like, how many years this was a requirement for broadcasting companies?
Again, there are probably better people I could connect you to, but I would say certainly the mid to late 60s was when it sort of first came into effect. There was not surprisingly, out of Quebec, where community TV seems to be a stronger force, a program called Challenge for Change, en français, of course.
Mm-hmm.
But it was a program which was connecting, more rural communities, shall we say, and gave them an opportunity to explore the new medium of television at that time. I didn't get involved until the late 80s, when, of course, TV wasn't new, but the idea of community TV was kind of flourishing in Canada and actually spread around the world. There were a number of countries that sort of looked at the sort of model that had risen out of Canada, where, cable companies were more or less mandated to provide the funding necessary to run a channel. The one mistake I think we made here is we actually let them run the channel as opposed to having them, like in the States, their funds that the cable companies put their monies into, and those funds are tapped into by community groups that produce local programming. And that's probably what should have been done here, because as we can see, over time, corporate greed kind of peeled back until it disappeared completely. And I'm not surprised you haven't heard of community TV. I'm sure many of your listeners probably have never heard of it either, because it disappeared really in the late 90s. And it made a bit of a comeback when people tried to rally against the closures, but it was really kind of a foregone conclusion that the cable companies didn't want to pour all the money they need into it. So, as soon as they got the opportunity from the CRTC to put money into other avenues, as we saw locally, Shaw shut down their channel almost within a year.
Right. And what Sid said is that Shaw gives community TV money now to local news?
Well, this is what the CRTC has allowed. So again, I try not to complain too much about Shaw per se. They're doing what probably any corporate entity would do when the government says, hey, you don't have to put all this money into running a community channel. Instead, if you can find another means of providing more local content, will consider it. And of course, what Shaw has done is I'm not sure all the legalities. I believe either they own Global or they're both owned by another entity, what have you. There's a lot of corporate overlap there, but they choose, rather than to run a community channel, to put all that money into Global TV, and then Global TV in turn says, well, we'll get out there and we'll do more local content. Which, to be fair, I have seen some more, on occasion, local live programming from different events throughout the Lower Mainland, but certainly not the, grassroots local content that used to be provided by community television.
Right. Okay. In sum, basically, community television existed from the 60s to the 90s in Canada. It still exists, like, where you are in the Tri-City area, but it was made up of money mandated by the CRTC from broadcasting companies in order to empower local communities and allow them to make their own television. Is that sort of a good summary?
Yeah, more or less, I think you've got that right. A couple of things just in that... when you say we exist out here in the Tri-Cities, I mean, we lost, like everybody else, the avenue to air our programming on Shaw when they closed down their channel last year. So the one thing that we really had going, probably above all the other community groups, were that we always fought for the fact that being out here in the Tri-Cities, having access to like a gear in Vancouver was of no use to us. So maybe I should go back a little bit and explain too. In the old days of Rogers and then the handover to Shaw, that was when community TV really disappeared out of the lower mainland. So in the, say, late 80s, early 90s at one time, there were actually about a dozen offices open every community. I grew up in Kitsilano. There was an office just for Kitsilano where, you know, you could walk in and they would teach you to shoot and edit, and in return, I was producing programming on what was happening in my community. And those offices all slowly closed down. By the late 90s, there really wasn't very much open at all, centralized to the one office, and Shaw was now downtown Vancouver. And in fact, they had at one point basically told all the volunteers, we don't need you anymore, we'll produce our own programming. And this is when there was a bit of an upheaval across Canada from community groups who wanted to produce Access TV still. And eventually Shaw was required to open their doors again and at least allow programming to air. They did very minimal actual training or oversight, but they would just say, okay, if you bothered them enough and you could prove you could produce the programming, you were basically allowed to produce a segment that would air on their sort of volunteer hour of programming that they would sort of block everybody into. But that sort of existed for a while. Until recently, of course, when they were allowed to shut down their channel entirely. But over that amount of time, what we did out here in the Tri-Cities was sort of build bridges with all the community groups, raise funds through the cities, buy your own gear. So we essentially have our own sort of portable studio that we can set up and shoot interviews throughout the day and whatnot. This is, of course, the other community groups in Vancouver were relying on Shaw for the access to their studio. They don't have any of this now. If they're lucky, they may have a camera, but they still have volunteers who are interested. And what we're really hoping now is that TELUS may pick up where Shaw left off. They've been very supportive of us over the last couple of years. Matter of fact, when we were airing programming on Shaw without any support from Shaw, TELUS was actually giving us financial support to help do workshops and produce our programming.
Okay.
So they have shown a real strong support. Depending on when your deadline is for this story, I'd love to give you more information. I'm actually waiting right now to hear about our application that just went in a couple of days ago, but it seems very likely they may give us a substantial financial boost this year.
Cool, yeah. I mean, I can always follow up. I'm just still trying to wrap my head around this, like, because I didn't kind of grow up, I guess, in the 90s. I must have been privy to some community television, but so basically these broadcast companies like TELUS and Shaw, they had to set up also offices and have their staff train community members who were volunteers to make segments that they would air on some time slot on one of their channels.
Yes. So, to be fair, though, this was just either Rogers or Shaw. TELUS was only a phone company at that time.
Right.
But when those two companies were basically the big cable companies, and just to give you a little more background, essentially, Rogers was everything east of Calgary, and Shaw was everything west of Calgary, except for Vancouver. So Vancouver was basically run by Rogers, and there was some holding back east that was held by Shaw. So in the, I'd say, again, there are other better people to talk to about this, but I'd say the late 80s, early 90s, what happened is both the big companies got together and say, well, this is kind of stupid. We both have, a dividing line, and we both have little holdings that are, by each other, so why don't we just swap? So Shaw took over Rogers in Vancouver, and vice versa, Rogers took over some holding back east. And ever since then, it's been basically Shaw out here and Rogers out west.
Right.
Other way around. Rogers out east and Shaw out west. But the turnover here was nothing really more than a changing of the signage on the building. It was essentially all the same people. The company just became a Shaw-run company. But at that time, just before that switchover, was when, in accordance with the mandate, they were running a full-time community channel, which was basically every community had their own office. There were, depending on the size of the community, Kits, for example, only had two full-time staff members. But the Tri-Cities region, which was called the Fraser region at the time, I think they had five full-time staff members because, they were serving a much bigger area. They were serving Coquitlam, Port Moody, Poco, even out into Maple Ridge, what's the other? Anyways, a larger region.
Okay.
And then other regions like Richmond had their own, Surrey had their own, Burnaby had their own. So all these independent offices were places where volunteers off the street could basically come in, sign up to be a volunteer. They would get training that, it wasn't BCIT level training, but it was probably a couple of workshops on how to operate a camera, how to frame a shot, how to follow action, and then given access to camera gear. And, of course, keep in mind, this is, again, back 80s, 90s, especially the 80s, camera gear was not something that everybody had. It wasn't on your phone, certainly, and, if you're lucky and had a lot of money, you maybe had a fairly professional camera, but there weren't even, necessarily camcorders around at the time, so you were learning a very valuable trade, and in return, you were producing programming that benefited the community.
Okay, and so, so now Shaw, which is out west, because changes in CRTC regulations have come into being since the late 90s, they now give funding to Global to produce local news coverage. Why was there this shift in the CRTC that allowed a company like Shaw, a television company like Shaw or Rogers, to instead fund existing news channels rather than like community-made television?
Well, that's a very good question. Probably the crux of your report, maybe. At one time, when the CRTC and the government set up television, the idea was there were three pillars, and the one was sort of governmental programming, the other was commercial programming or private, however you want to call it, and the third was community having some sort of access. And that value seems to have disappeared on the CRTC. They seem to think, actually when the internet came to being, they seemed to sort of at that time think, oh, well, that's good enough. Now people can have their own, here's where people can have their own say. So it's not necessarily really for people to have their own say anymore. It's about, I guess there were different aspects of it that they seemed to be able to say, okay, well, we just don't need it anymore.
Right. Well, the internet, that seems like a timely reason that, at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, that people would see that as a way to replace community television.
Right. Well, and to be fair, as everybody says to me, why are you bothering with TV at all? The future's the internet, down the road, whether it's the Netflix of the world or what have you, that, it'll all meld into one, and that's perhaps going to be the case. But, either way, the aspect of having some sort of community-led programming, I think, is important. But this is where the idea of saying the internet is good enough falls to the ground, because that's just anybody out there with a camcorder shooing something. It's not a concerted effort that's coordinated by, a couple of key people that, work with the community to ensure that we're producing programming that, promotes and covers what's happening in the community. It's just anybody throwing out a message from, leave Brittany alone to what have you, right? If you have a kitten involved, even so much the better.
So
in our market, of course, we're trying to market just to the Tri-Cities. We don't expect to get millions of hits, but, we just want to promote what's happening at the local art centers, cultural centers, historical societies, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're probably much like CITR. I guess, community television seems like it's a lot like community radio stations.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that, to me, is the quandary. It's like, how can we have, I mean, I know a CITR, of course, you're built in with a university, which is awesome, but there's co-op radio out there as well, right? And it's like, well, how can that exist and there can't be some virtual co-op TV, if you will? You know, it's basically the same idea. It's access for people to get some training, and in return they practice. You know, I used to teach my last couple of years in the industry, and, you know, really you learn by practicing, and by whether it's a volunteer or whether you're paying money to go to school, doesn't really matter. It's just you got to get out there and work the gear and get better at it. And what we try and do is say, well, we'll give you access to the gear, we'll give you a bit of training, and all we ask in return now is the programming you do to hone your skills is programming that benefits our community here.
Yeah, absolutely.
So it's sort of a win-win.
Sounds very similar. Yeah, absolutely. I'm curious then, would you be, as long as you could train folks and give them access to equipment, would you be as happy having a YouTube channel or some sort of maybe segment on Netflix? You mentioned Netflix. Or is it still important to you to have an actual television channel to broadcast programming?
Well, currently we are only on YouTube, and certainly we feel the audience has dropped somewhat, but we have spent the last couple of years trying to bring audience over from Shaw viewership to our YouTube channel. I think right now it's still important to be carried somewhere. So right now, again, as I said, we're waiting to hear back from TELUS. It's very likely they may have our offerings available on their on-demand services, which just is another audience for us, right? So I think the more places you can make your programming available, the more important thing is if we can get some funding from them to the level of being able to actually, you know, promote ourselves in our community, that kind of thing, that would be hugely beneficial as well.
Do you see there being any move back, either like a push from the community or from the CRTC itself, back to funding for community television specifically away from this change where broadcast television companies fund instead existing news organizations that provide local coverage? Like, do you see it switching back to the way it was anytime soon?
I don't know about anytime soon, but I'm a big believer in that whole pendulum kind of theory that I think it's time it eventually starts swinging back into the favor of local content and having another voice out there that's not controlled by seemingly the same couple of voices that seem to control a lot of the media is one aspect of it. Of course, the aspect I focus more on is just having local content and programming promoting a very regional level of what's happening in your community. Either way, I do see a swing back to there being more support. I think partially due to examples like the one we're setting here in the Tri-Cities, more so if people look over the borders a little further to places like Quebec, where community TV is very strong. I think that needs to be looked at, and hopefully we can be led by that example.
Okay, great. Well, I should probably leave it there. Thank you so much for your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Great.
Take care. Bye.
Take care.
You know what's better than reading a great magazine? Reading a great magazine that also helps you fight poverty. Megaphone Magazine is sold by homeless and low-income vendors on the streets of Vancouver and Victoria. Vendors buy magazines for 75 cents and sell them for $2. It's flexible, low-barrier work for people who may not have access to traditional jobs. Download the Megaphone app to find vendors and buy the magazine, even when you don't have change.
I faced it. I have Alzheimer's disease.
My diagnosis has let me get on with my life my way.
The more we learned about my grandfather's dementia, the more we could face the future and make plans.
My husband Tom and I spoke to our doctor right away.
I have Alzheimer's, but it doesn't have me.
I faced it.
So can you.
For more information about early diagnosis, visit alzheimer.ca.
Strength, dignity, respect, beauty, self-worth, safety, confidence, choice, hope. The Beauty Night Society is a registered charity dedicated to helping marginalized women introduce trust, hope, and self-esteem into their lives. This is the
first day of Through its popular makeover program, the Beauty Night Society has touched the lives of thousands and reintroduced a healthy touch to the lives of vulnerable women throughout British Columbia, creating real life makeovers.
Please visit www.beautynight.org for information on programs and on how to help. Beauty Night, because dignity is beautiful. I think I was blind before I met
you. Hello, and we're back. You're listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. Just heard a couple ads, and before that, we had a piece on community television and the documentarian and activist Sid Chautan. So that was pretty cool. The interview I played at the end, which was with Jeff Scott of Tri-Cities Television, was unedited because I did not have time to edit it. Today was a bit of a stressful rush to get the show together, which is often the way it is. So I'm going to edit that more properly and kind of tighten up that piece a bit. And I think I'll probably put it out on Seeking Office. Seeking Office has been in a weird limbo. So it, I guess, was like a pop-up podcast for the election. I mean, it was. But then the idea of continuing it arose. And though I don't really have time to work for free, I like it. I like making news pieces. So and the News Collective sometimes also makes news pieces, and we all have to talk about keeping it going, but it might keep going in a new iteration, so probably a new podcast, but it would be like, you know, similar to Seeking Office. So keep on the lookout for that. But my plan right now is to put that community TV story, a tightened up version of it, on Seeking Office. So that will probably happen. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, I definitely think that we need more city
Who
council.
Are you?
Sorry, I'm just jumping in. I'm Christina Song, yeah. And I have not been on for a while, but I have been in the past part of Democracy Watch.
Indeed.
Yeah, and you know what? I think it's true, like it's hard to get stuff done in like a federal level, but it's policy changes in municipal level so fast, so quick, and so dramatic. So
there's Dora waving to us.
I think municipal elections and municipal policies are often overlooked, and it's to the detriment of our entertainment.
That's well said. Yeah, it's so funny. Now I like don't care at all about federal politics. Like I do, but federal and international stuff, I'm like, yeah, whatever. Trump's doing some stuff. Like I'm super into local stuff because it's like drama about people you know.
Yeah, and
you
people know? Are way crazier.
People are way crazy here. Yeah. So what piece are we hearing next, Christina?
So next we're bringing you coverage on the rally at City Hall. Yesterday, members of the Vancouver Tenants Union arrived to speak at council in support of motions put forth by Councillor Jean Swanson. Yay! These motions
we're objective.
Nonpartisan.
We feel nothing about Jean Swanson.
Right. These motions involved vacancy control, banning rent evictions across Vancouver, and building 100% welfare and pension rate social housing at 58 West Hastings. Many of these motions relating to affordable housing held large support from people from East Vancouver. Sorry. In an effort to combat rampant gentrification affecting the local community. However, upon a deeper look into the rally, we found a history of profiling and democratic suppression from the side of the city council. Let's take a listen.
Ooh, or the city council, or like security at city council.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, it's actually the security at city council, not city council
not
itself.
Not the elected councilors.
Yeah, long gone are the days where politicians wield knives and, you know.
So true. All right, here we go. Let's hear this report from City Hall.
Let me give you a taste of the new council. Gregor's gone.
his decade is over. It's a whole new horizon for Vancouver City Hall.
Here we are in front of City Hall at 12th and Cambie, where the Vancouver Tenants Union, or VTU, and the group Our Homes Can't Wait are on the steps of City Hall. Both groups fight for rent control and other renter and low-income tenant rights in Vancouver.
One is motion B4 for 58 West Hastings to ensure that the city recommit to its promise of 100% welfare and pension rate housing at 58 West Hastings. Two is an end to rent evictions. That's motion B10.
Marina Clausen. I'm a community organizer in the Downtown East Side as well as with the VTU.
I was wondering what you guys are here protesting exactly, specifically what are you trying to get out of today?
So it's not a protest per se, it's a rally for speaker support. So essentially it's similar to like if you had court support that would show up and show solidarity to support the tenants that are coming forward for both Motion 4 and Motion 10. Motion 4 being to build 100% social housing at welfare and pension rate at 58 West Hastings, and Motion 10 to implement vacancy control and ban rent evictions in Vancouver. So there's two motions that are going forward that are really affecting tenants, among a bunch of other motions that also will have an impact on tenants, but those are the two ones we're here to represent. So there will be speakers, tenant speakers, that are coming here today to speak in front of City Hall. We've just been told that the city council is going to go into a closed session for the next 3 hours. So we were expecting that people would be able to continue to speak after this event, but it seems like they're going to go on a break, and both those motions have been tabled to hear speakers tomorrow.
I overheard you talking about how, you know, no one should be allowed to enter certain chambers, how you were confronted by security guards. Would you mind talking about that experience?
Yeah, it's not my first time coming to City Hall for an action or to speak at City Hall. And I've experienced the security, it's not the working person that is the security guard that is the problem. The problem is that they get orders from the security head. I'm not sure who's in that leadership role now, but I've had in the past security block participants from coming into this public space, City Hall, because they're concerned about protest inside that space, even though we have a legal right to do that. But they can sometimes close off people from entering the chambers, which I think is unethical.
So are there specific people that they're profiling, like members of the VTU specifically, people who are with you?
They have profiled before, especially Downtown East Side activists. Absolutely. This hasn't happened yet today. Like, we know that we're going into closed session. I don't know that that's caused by the fact that there is going to be a rally here or not. I'm waiting to see why they chose to close the session for the next 3 hours. But I got to say, there's a bunch of tenants that are not happy that it's being delayed even further to hear public speakers.
Marina had to take off, but she left us with questions about her claim, which, if you missed it, was that low-income people prior to protesting or rallying were being prohibited from speaking and sitting in on the council chambers. I approached a security guard and was referred to head of security.
So from my own experience here, the only group that I guess has been cordoned off, unfortunately, have the combination of being part of a disruptive group as well as looking as if they live on the streets or a low-income family. That's never the reason as to why they are cordoned off. This is a public space for everybody to attend. It's only to do with the safety and security of the sanctity of the council chambers as well as the safety of people in City Hall. So if they have been associated with or have been personally disruptive, regardless of skin, color, race, sexual orientation, origin, religion, anything like that, that is the only particular reason as to why they would be allowed or disallowed access into certain parts or the entirety of the building. Mm-hmm. Obviously, people get passionate. I'm never against it. I think I fight for all of this as well. It's just kind of hard being on the other side, but also feeling obviously compassionate and empathetic for what people are fighting for. I'm generally, unfortunately, even though I'm standing here, I want to be out there with them. So I see both sides of it, but I would never physically threaten someone. But I think sometimes when people are so passionate and so angry but don't have the right way to vocabulary it towards my direction, I think that perceives as anger, or that's their way of kind of just spitting it out versus I'm with them. I appreciate the passion. I think everybody has a voice and a right to say things. Just don't direct them at me, basically.
So clearly there's a difference of opinion between security and the protesters regarding what's been going on. We were curious to find out what those rallying would think about her statements, so we went back outside. We came out of City Hall to a now much more populated rally. Several activist leaders spoke, but Vincent Tao, a member and leader of the group Our Homes Can't Wait, shared his experience regarding Vancouver City Hall in the last 2 days.
Well, no, there's several ways in which City Council has been able to, make sure that people cannot democratically participate in their government. She's also lying about that. We would roll up and we're with Vandu folks that live on the streets. We get profiled from far away and we look like poor folks, right? And then they immediately send a bunch of security guards to lock down the space. So that's their lockdown procedure. But even in the regular kind of workings of City Hall, their bureaucratic web structure does not work at all. They've actually made it harder for us to sign up to even speak. Their website has changed with the new government such that you could only sign up one person to speak per IP address. So that means that in the downtown east side, where typically people don't have devices, they don't have laptops, they can't sign up on their own. They need someone to sign up for them. They don't let you do that anymore. And also the time of day in which they hold these meetings where people should be speaking publicly, it's 9 to 5, literally, if not further into the day. And they don't tell you what time to come by. So they're trying to make sure that no one comes. And that's how this shit happens. It's not really a democracy. If they're making it really hard, it's essentially speaker suppression or democratic suppression.
So Vincent Tao, if you missed it, made the claim that Taylor Guerin, security operations coordinator, was lying about the profiling of low-income people.
So as a third party, it doesn't really seem as though they're trying to kick you off the steps. Could you elaborate on that?
Before you guys got here, they sent out a few security guards that were telling us to get off the steps.
Oh. So we were talking to a member of the VTU, I think a very important member of the VTU, and she said that you guys were keeping it really low key. When I arrived, there were six people. So did you all kind of go somewhere else and then come right back? Is that what happened, sort of?
I was inside because there was still council stuff happening, but when I came out, there were about 10 people, and they were just setting up the microphone and the speaker and the AV stuff. And then, three security guards came out and told them that we had to vacate because we're blocking a path on these steps. And as many of the people that, were with us today were saying, we've been protesting on these steps for years now, right? We've never been told to get off these steps. This is public property. This is, city property, and we should be able to assemble on it.
A little later on, we attended City Council chambers and sat in for a while to see what was going on as they came back from an in-camera session at 3 p.m. The new council, still breaking itself in, were discussing procedure and adding amendments to amendments to amendments while discussing the citywide plan to tackle key citywide challenges like housing affordability and densification. While listening, there was one standout moment for us. And that was when Councillor Christine Boyle of One City called a matter of urgent business to Council's attention. A motion to address biased policing in response to the profiling of Desmond Cole, a Black activist and journalist who says he was profiled and carded. There was a certain irony to City Council having this conversation while those outside rallying were also claiming to have experienced profiling, in the form of having their right to demonstrate infringed upon by being asked to move from City Hall steps and having members of their organization prevented from entering the chamber. The assertion of these activists is that they have been profiled for appearing low income. This is Samuel Jones, signing out.
Whoa, that was so good. That was really good. I'm sorry, that was a great piece. I'm saying this because I did not put it together, though I did help. But I'm really impressed with you guys. I have the story. Let's go back if you missed it. Like, that sucks, because that was really good. It was a story put together by the Amazing News Collective that I am so proud of, and it was on a rally outside City Hall yesterday by the VTU and Our Homes Can't Wait. They were supporting a couple motions put forward by co-counselor Jean Swanson, which were in favor of social housing at 58 West Hastings, as well as making it harder or stopping rent evictions for profit from happening. But what happened was that Lyndon, who I have in studio here, and Sam Jones, who's not in studio but, you know, spent a lot of time editing this as well, sort of found a sub-story happening, which was one of profiling. And then Christina, who I also have in studio, as well as Ola, who's in the other room leading a training, did an excellent job editing this all together. So I am just really impressed. It's very clear, because I hadn't heard that piece before we played it now. And I would like to talk to both of you about it. So first of all, Christina, how are you feeling about it? Because you've been here for a few hours editing.
Oh, you know, just my reality doesn't feel real. Like,
yeah, of editing.
Yeah, I just feel like my mind's been sucked into like a computer monitor.
Oh, yeah, for sure. That's like my state of being like much of the time. Yeah.
Yeah.
So Lyndon, reporter, sound guy.
Yeah.
Okay, so you were at this rally, and then how did you and Sam get into this sort of sub-narrative of the profiling of low-income folks?
Yeah, well, immediately when we headed to City Hall, we went there before the rally started. So it was around the time when Marina, the VTU organizer, was preparing for the rally. And so when we were talking to her, immediately she kind of brought up that fact, and she wanted to make it a focus when we were talking to her. And, you know, we also heard, like, she wanted to keep it low-key, and there was definitely discussion between the security guards beforehand. Like, you know, they told them they couldn't be on the steps at the City Hall, which where most of the rally took place and where people were speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so, you know, we kind of expected them to be really passionate about the issue itself and talk about that, but they drew a lot of focus immediately to how they were essentially profiled and kind of prevented from entering, and also kind of pressured from basically security as well.
Right. And so I guess it's a matter of, in terms of sort of like talking about the reporting process, so when you're interviewing someone, you kind of hear these hints, right? It's like, oh, well, we're trying to keep things really low key. And then like as a reporter, you start to think, you know, why is that? And then did it come out naturally, or did you actually have to ask and dig into that, or did it kind of like become just obvious that they were talking about being profiled?
Yeah, well, we kind of asked that to as a starter question, just to, you know, establish just the context of how the rally was held. But, you know, it kind of became this really big part, because, you know, even after that, when we talked to Vincent,
mm-hmm.
He also brought up that fact, and it was a pretty big deal, because he also talked about, you know, being profiled and being censored. And that was a very big part of, honestly, their rally. Because they felt like they were being underrepresented, especially because, you know, they're from the east side.
Mm-hmm.
And they felt like, you know, it was collectively kind of falling to oppression.
Right. And then, so I know one of the pushes the VTU had, the Vancouver Tenants Union, was to get their members and just concerned folks to sign up to speak in front of council, right? And so can you tell me what happened with that? Did everyone get to speak? Were these motions that Jean tabled, voted on and resolved, or were they moved to be discussed another time?
Yeah, when we went there, we went at 12:30, and it's pretty surprising that the turnout was that good, because a lot of these people have jobs.
What was the turnout like, roughly?
Like around 30 people.
Okay, yeah.
Which was pretty good. Mm. Essentially, they had told us that the original hearings about basically this motion was supposed to be the day before, and that they had pushed it back to basically November 14th.
Right.
Right. And then, but even during that time, it was pushed back today at 9 a.m. because they would repeatedly push it back to like 5 a.m. And by that time, A lot of these people have jobs, they have families, mm-hmm. so they can't stay from 9 to 5,
yeah,
essentially.
5 p.m., yeah.
Right? So, you know, that was a very big point of contention between everyone because, you know, they felt like they were being censored and also being, like, intentionally being kind of restricted and that they were kind of preying on the fact that, you know, their job isn't to be at city council.
Yeah, I mean, I know that's an ongoing point of contention, not just with Downtown Eastside focused activist groups, but more broadly with just people who want to speak at City Hall on any issue. Is like, it's often during the day and people generally work during the day. You know, some people might not, but so I don't know if there's like if that's something City Council is thinking about or working on, but that's been identified as like a sort of barrier to local democracy functioning as well as it could. And then so with the motions Jean put forward, motion 4 and 10, which were later moved on the agenda, we found to 7 and 12. It's irrelevant. But they remain unresolved, right? I should have looked up today because, as you said, more people spoke this morning. As far as I know, I don't think they were voted on. But we can check on that. Perhaps some of our listeners already know from just following Twitter and stuff. I did look on Twitter earlier and didn't see much. But anyway, so I'm also interested in the editing process for this piece. Christina, you kind of jumped in on this halfway. So Lyndon and Sam did the reporting. This is kind of a behind the scenes on how the News Collective, when we function as a collective, like puts pieces together. So you were kind of thrown in. Sam and I had worked on the script and then you had to sort of put it all together until Ola came in. But how did you find that? Like, were you piecing things? Did you go right off the script or were you like listening for cues to like really get things together tightly? How did you approach the editing process?
Well, I was mostly following the script, but I was trying to piece together which part of the audio would be the most interesting in which places. And so the Vincent Tao speech at the beginning of the clip, I thought was like so dramatic.
Totally.
It was great. And Lyndon, he chose the music for this piece, and I was like, yeah, this is great. And also, Ola loved it. Ola also helped edit, so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It seems like music Ola would like, too. Like, I feel like Ola often chooses good music. This
he
is
does.
Sad facts.
Yeah.
But, yeah, like, yeah, really good. Especially, like, if you compare the piece I did earlier, didn't have any music. It's, like, a much, like, slower kind of energy.
Mm. I think sometimes the music is, like, too much. Mm-hmm. Like, it seems extraneous, but, you know, it fits in certain places, especially when it's like deep, dark secret council or city council stuff, you know. I thought it fit with the atmosphere pretty well.
Yeah, totally. And how did you find the music, Lyndon?
I found it on a free website, which...
Sick.
Yeah.
Which one?
Like
freemusic.org?
.org, yeah.
Really? Oh, that's pretty good for freemusic.org. I do use that a lot.
I love it when you can be so literal with internet, like free music. Thank
yeah,
you.
Yeah. Just, yeah, right to the point.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's sweet, though. Yeah, it's hard finding free music or copyright accessible music for shows like this. So, yeah, because you really have to work within, like, a limited resources, and then you might not always be able to, find the tone that you want. Anyway.
But it did take him a very long time to pick the music, and I think that's just a testament to how thorough he is.
Good job, Lyndon.
Thanks.
The music is really good. Like, look, John Q out there supports the music. Shout out to John Q. Great. Any last words? Any antidote you want to leave us with, Lyndon, from your reporting out in the field? Covering democracy.
Just the fact that I don't think this was made clear in the report. But when we did talk to the security guard, she did say that she was not responsible for any of the profiling.
Mm.
However, she did say that she's in charge of threat analysis, which is essentially the same thing.
That's true. You have to analyze a threat,
yeah.
Which is sort of like analyzing a person.
Yeah, I mean, like, seeing if I feel like she's been sort of trained to give statements like that, like,
yeah,
oh, we want to be inclusive.
And... yeah, well, she listed, like, the 3 O's, sexual orientation, race, gender, like, that's...
Yeah, and I mean, it's her job, like, I don't know. We're objective, so we have no perception, really, on, you know.
I mean, yeah, the fact that she did talk to us was pretty big, you know, good for her, I guess.
Yeah. But I mean, yeah, that's, you know, security, I think that's kind of the business they're in.
Sorry, I just wanted to, like, leave off on, like, a happier note.
Yes.
If you guys are ever bored and like cat videos, apparently there, and it's related to the story, I swear.
Really?
There's like a museum in Japan, like Hiroshima
in Japan.
Art Museum. Yeah, and
how
there
is
are
that
these
help us.
And these two cats keep trying to get into the museum, and there are these museum employees whose job it is to like just make sure that they don't get in. So there are video clips of them, like, acting adorable, trying to get into the museum.
They're literal cats?
Yeah, they're, like, little
They're being
strays.
Profiled.
They're being profiled for being cats. They're so cute.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. That's Just look crazy. It up.
Sorry, I have a cold. That is crazy, those poor cats.
Mm-hmm.
All right, well, this is the show. We basically started on time and basically ended on time, which is quite good for us. Because we are volunteers. And so I'm Alex DeBoer.
Christina Song.
Lyndon Wong.
And thank you for listening to Democracy Watch on CITR 101.9 FM. At this point, I will introduce the next show, which is often Flashback with Alec Christensen or No Dead Air. And they rotate, so I'm not sure. But one of them will be coming up. So thank you so much for tuning in. Check out Seeking Office. I'm going to put up that report on the VTU and the rally outside City Hall last night because I'm happy with the way it turned out. And yeah, we'll be back again next Thursday at 5 p.m. on CITR. Keep listening.